Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty, along with Rita Dunaway, and this is the fourth program in which we are challenged with compelling reasons for why you can't stay silent. Many of these reasons come from a book by that name written by Tom Minnery, former vice president of Focus on the Family. In case you missed it, our first three programs focused on the challenge we all face in standing up and speaking out for biblical truth in a world that is in such need of that truth today, and yet which seems so unwilling to receive it. Therefore, our program today focuses on God's call on each of us to carry that truth to all the world in everything that we do and say. That call comes to us, Rita, in two ways, often referred to as the creation mandate and the cultural mandate. The creation mandate, first of all, is God's call on all of us to care for the environment that He has created for us. In the first chapter of Genesis, God says that we are to be good stewards of His creation and to have dominion over it. Then, moving on to the cultural mandate, which is also referred to as the Great Commission, is God's call on all of us to go into the world, teaching them to observe everything that He has commanded us to do, the creation mandate and the cultural mandate. Now, it's interesting that the Declaration of Independence refers to both of these when it refers to the laws of nature and of nature's God. Two sets of laws. God has given us both of these laws as mandates for how we should live. So, Rita, break this down for us. What does Minnery say about all of this?
Well, thanks, Dean. I love in this chapter how Minnery points out that when most of us think of God as the creator, we tend to think of the natural world. I know I do. That's mm-hmm. what comes to mind for me first. But the fact is that God is the one who established an order for everything, weather patterns, seasons, natural laws like gravity, and even the laws for the way our society and our relationships and our culture is supposed to work best. As you pointed out, the cultural mandate as well. After God created everything, He did something extraordinary. He delegated to mankind the job of tending and cultivating His creation.
He gave us that mandate, but He also made it very clear to Noah and his descendants in Genesis chapter 9 that He would someday demand an accounting for how man fulfilled his responsibility, and in particular, his responsibility for caring for His people, which, of course, are God's most precious creatures from creation.
Right, because people are the only ones of His creation made in His image, right? So that really sets mankind apart clearly from the rest of creation.
And it's a delegation of authority. We have responsibility for caring.
Yes. It's the next point in this chapter that Minnery made that really hit home with me, Dean. He points out that on the one hand, we can see how certain of God's laws must be obeyed. The law of gravity is the best and most obvious example. If a person steps off a window ledge, he or she will fall. We all know that. So we all respect and obey the law of gravity immediately. But on the other hand, there are laws that have consequences that are less immediate, though no less real. So often, man tends to disobey those laws. These are the laws that tell us how we're to live as families and communities, how we're to live under God's authority as self-governing people, the laws that tell us what justice is. And not only is it that we disobey these because we don't always see the consequences of disobedience right away, but because in our society, so many of our leaders don't even see that these laws, which are also God's laws, once again, they are just as fixed and true as the law of gravity.
Rita, that passage struck me as well. We understand the laws of gravity, the laws of nature. But I have a tendency, and I imagine many of our listeners do as well, that these other laws are merely suggestions. Yes. I remember Ted Koppel saying about the Ten Commandments, these are God's commandments, not just suggestions, and they are as absolute and as fixed as the natural laws. But Rita, here's what is so troubling. We have paid a huge price for neglecting those laws. We've mentioned these two issues numerous times in our programs, but they need to be repeated and we need to be reminded. Let's take, first of all, the laws pertaining to life. This is a first law. It's the first inalienable right referred to in the Declaration of Independence. We have violated God's gift of life by destroying unborn babies. Some 58 million who have been aborted since the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973. Rita, that is over 3,000 abortions every day in America. That is a violation of one of God's most sacred and immutable laws. But then there's a second one. It's the institution of marriage. In his creation, God created man and woman to be committed to each other in the institution and the covenant of marriage, to multiply and to care for our world. Yet, we have too often broken that covenant of marriage with him and with each other through casual hookups and cohabitation before marriage, through a divorce rate that affects nearly half of our families, and now even by redefining marriage to include same-sex partners. Those are only two areas of many in which we are disobeying, disregarding, ignoring, dismissing God's laws for our lives.
You know, I have to comment on that before we go on, Dean. Wouldn't you agree that it's really beyond dispute, a pure matter of statistics, that the breakdown of the family has caused so much of the problems we have in society today, the increase in crime, the increase in poverty, all these deep and significant societal problems that we witness in our society can be directly linked back at some point to the breakdown of families. Wouldn't you say that's beyond dispute? And yet, why do we not seem to get it?
Well, Rita, for those people who think that the most important issue in America today, particularly in the lead up to our November elections, is the economy, stupid. The breakdown of the family is not just a social issue, not just a moral issue. It is an economic issue. And there have been studies done that show the actual dollars and cents that are wasted, that are thrown away because of the breakdown of the family.
Yeah, so we are paying the price.
In many ways.
We are experiencing the consequences of ignoring and violating God's laws in these regards. Dean, I have a question for you. Do you think our founding fathers would have been surprised that our nation looks the way it does today if they had known that God's laws would be treated with the contempt that they are today?
Well, it's a cliche, but I think it is probably literally true. They are turning over in their graves as we speak.
Yeah.
Just to verify that, the mentality, the morality, the godliness of our founding fathers, let me cite just a couple of examples. Let's go back to our first two presidents, who I think said it perhaps best when they emphasized the importance of keeping God's laws. George Washington, for example, in his farewell address, said that religion and morality are indispensable supports for America's political prosperity. And he could have added economic prosperity as well. He added that the smile of heaven can never be expected on a nation that disregards the eternal rules of order and right which heaven itself has ordained. And it just makes me wonder, is God smiling on our culture today, or is he weeping as Jesus wept over Jerusalem? The second of our founding fathers, the second president, reinforced what George Washington said when he said, and I quote, "Religion and virtue are the only foundations on which free governments and social happiness can be found. He might have added economic prosperity again. I'd like to add two other things. They're not our founding fathers, but they simply show that this is a truism that has continued for us in today. Alexis de Tocqueville, a French statesman, came to America in the 1830s to find out what made America tick. Here's what he said. First of all, he said, I was surprised. America's strength is not in its factories and in its farms so much as it is in its churches. And he said, he concluded after several years of just studying America, America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, she will cease to be great.
Wow.
And one final quote to show that this is not just ancient history that we ought to just ignore. President Reagan said it this way, if we ever forget that we are one nation under God, then we will be a nation gone under. Mm. And I think many of us see ourselves on that slippery slope today.
You know, to be fair, I think that at this point,
we're all about
folks,
fairness.
Yes, we are. Folks tend to reasonably ask the question, well, what is the place of God's laws in our society? Since we know that we are forbidden under the First Amendment to establish Christianity as an official national religion, we would agree that is what the First Amendment's Establishment Clause means.
I think I hear something coming up about separation of church and
state. No, no,
oh!
Because that, okay. As you know, Dean, that phrase is not anywhere in the Constitution.
Oh,
what the Establishment Clause forbids,
yes,
is the establishment of an official national religion. So I think, yes, it's fair that when people hear us talking about the importance of God's laws and us as a society obeying God's laws, they might say, well, how can that be? So I just want to point out that in my study of First Amendment jurisprudence and the history of the First Amendment, the way I understand the founders' intention was to absolutely protect the individual against any type of coercion to perform any type of religious exercise. So that's not what we're talking today. We're not talking about going out and making every American be a believer or profess Christ, because the founders would have said that Americans don't have to profess belief in any particular faith. We're not going to coerce people to believe something. They knew that that wouldn't work anyway. It's not effective. They believed that Americans should not be coerced to financially support any particular national church. But the founders absolutely expected that the laws of our government would be based on the common morality that was universally shared and was absolutely based on Judeo-Christian beliefs.
Well, and Rita, just so in case our listeners are a little skeptical of our claims, this is not just our opinion. The Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled, particularly in a case in 1892, but cases following, that America was founded as a Christian nation.
Yes.
And so this is historical fact, not just personal opinion. Well, Rita, in this next section then, Minnery points out that all mankind, deep down, is well aware of God's natural order. First of all, there's a passage in Psalm 19, verse 104, where it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmaments show his handiwork." And then get this, "There is no speech, there is no language, where their voice is not heard." That is the voice of the heavens declaring the glory of God. "That line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." Everybody knows. And then one more from the New Testament, Romans chapter 1 and also a verse in chapter 2, where Paul writes, "Our knowledge of God is manifest in the creation, for the invisible things of God are clearly seen and understood from his creation of the world." Therefore, and this is the punchline, there is no excuse for anyone not to know about God and his eternal power, for the requirements of his law are written on their hearts.
I love those passages, Dean. They are packed
they
and
are
wonderful. But the point here, for our purposes, is that regardless of what people think about God, whether they submit to God, or how much people know about the Bible, all people, every person everywhere, can discern between right and wrong. Or in other words, there is an absolute moral truth that is known to all mankind. And that is such a controversial statement in today's society. I want to read you a quote from C.S. Lewis that Minnery uses in this chapter of his book, but I think it's so powerful, so it's a little bit long, but bear with me. C.S. Lewis said, "Everyone has heard people quarreling. They say things like this, 'How'd you like it if anyone did the same to you?' Or, 'That's my seat. I was there first.' 'Leave him alone. He isn't doing you any harm.' Now, what interests me about these remarks is that the person who makes them is not merely saying that the other man's behavior does not happen to please him. He is appealing to some kind of standard of behavior, which he expects the other man to know about. And the other man very seldom replies to behavior with your standard. Nearly always, he tries to make out that what he has been doing does not really go against the standard, or that if it does, there is some special excuse. It looks, in fact, very much as if both parties had in mind some kind of law or rule of fair play or decent behavior or morality or whatever you like to call it about which they really agreed." And Dean, isn't that a wonderful summary and argument and explanation of this idea of an absolute moral truth, that even people who say that they don't believe there is an absolute truth, if you look at their behavior and their attitudes and issues like this, they really do.
I acknowledge that, Rita. I agree with that. How can I disagree with that? But here's the problem. Not everybody adheres to that absolute truth, because there has come to be a common saying in our culture today, "Do not judge." Therefore, that leads to the conclusion that everybody can do whatever they want. And it brings me back to the last verse in the book of Judges, where everybody did what was right in his own eyes. Mm-hmm. And we see the chaos and the violence that erupts when that happens.
So you're pointing out, Dean, that people may decide that it's okay for them to go against the standard. But I think what C.S. Lewis in particular does so well is to point out that whether all people adhere to the standard or not, there is, in fact, an absolute standard, an absolute truth that people know about and are fully aware of.
Well, and Lewis goes on to offer several examples. He explains that traits like selfishness have never been admired in any culture. Here's a second one. "There has never been a country where men are rewarded for running away in battle."
So courage is an absolute standard. It is seen as good.
And cowardice is the contrary of that, which culture does not admire or respect. Therefore, Minnery challenged the idea, and we've referred to this, that our society really believes that anything goes. He says this is a result of shallow thinking in our age. And unfortunately, it seems to be on the increase.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dean, that really takes us up to chapter 8 of the book, where Tom Minnery takes on the question of what it means to love the world. This is an important question to consider, because we tend to talk in jargon sometimes without examining the meaning of the words and phrases we use. For instance, we know as Christians that we are supposed to avoid being worldly. 1 John 2:15 says, "Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." But we also know from John 3:16 that God so loved the world that he sent his Son into the world.
John writes too in his gospel that Jesus is the light of the world, but men do not receive or welcome the light because their deeds are evil. That is the reason why this, what we're saying today, is not welcomed by large portions of our culture. And that is what grieves us and what we are trying to restore. But then following on what you've just read, we also have the warning from Christ himself in John 15. What he says is, if the world hates you for speaking the truth, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. But as it is, you do not belong to the world, for I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. They will treat you this way because of my name. And you shouldn't be, I'm adding this,
yeah.
And you shouldn't be surprised when it happens.
So what we're really talking about then is how to love the world and how to be engaged with our society and our culture without ourselves becoming worldly or taking on the attitudes and values of the world. And I love that you reminded us of those words of Jesus. We so need to remember those words every time we are shunned, and we will be shunned for staying true to God's word and for standing up for the moral law that he has given us without compromise. We should expect the world to hate us.
Ask Jesus what happened to him when he stood up for truth.
That's right. But the next part may be even more challenging for us, and that is the part where we are to go into the world purposefully carrying God's message, even though we know in advance that the world will be hostile to that message and hostile to us as the carriers of the message.
Rita, that takes us back to the Great Commission. For so many years, I have always understood that to mean carry the gospel of salvation to all the world. But it adds, and teach them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. Jesus came not to discard the law, but to fulfill the law, and that law applies to all of us. Then furthermore, in Jesus' last hours, he prayed to the Father in John 17, called the priestly prayer, not that God would take us out of the world, but that he would protect us from the evil one. And then he said, as you sent me into the world, I have also sent them into the world.
That is a big challenge, Dean. Minnery says, and I quote, the unkind, unchristian, worldly system is to occupy the attention and energy of Christ's followers, end quote. This is a huge responsibility, but also, isn't it an exciting privilege that God has chosen us, his people, to be part of what he is actively doing in the world around us? At the end of the chapter, Minnery says this, and I'm just going to read this last paragraph in the chapter. Not surprisingly, some church leaders are embarrassed by Christians who try to address today's problems and earn only the merciless criticism of the secular news media. These leaders want Christians to back away from social engagement, to make Christianity acceptable and non-controversial. At the very time when there should be cohesion among Christians as they face the attacks and disappointments of a fallen world, these voices send a most uncertain sound. They tell Christians it is time to disengage from the world and retreat from confrontation with evil. And then in the next portion of the book, we will discuss those dissenters, Dean. But I wonder if you want to comment on that quote by Minnery.
Just a couple of things. Minnery also says in this chapter that the Bible knows only engagement with the world. It knows nothing of escape, even though taking on the world invites backlash and rejection. As you've indicated, we're going to address that head on next week when we talk about the next two chapters in his book. First of all, why some people shun engagement, and secondly, is activism always ugly? Many people turn away from speaking out on these things because of the rejection, the ridicule, the hostility, and even the physical violence that it often generates among those who do not fear God, who do not honor God, and who do not know God. So we have a big, big road ahead of us. And I just really appreciate Minnery's teaching on this. I should note, too, that our listeners, if you'd like to get a copy of the book, can go to Amazon.com. And the name of the book is Why You Can't Stay Silent by Tom Minnery, M-I-N-N-E-R-Y.
You know, Dean, this whole discussion brought to mind for me one of my favorite Martin Luther King Jr. quotes. And when King was leading the fight against racial injustice back in the 60s, he said, "In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends." And, you know, I would just plead with our listeners and with the churches and Christians in the community to not stay silent in the face of evil and injustice. And before we close today, I just wanted to bring in another book that I read within the past year. It's a great book. It's called What is the Mission of the Church? And it's by Kevin DeYoung and Greg Gilbert. And in one section of the book, they actually make a list of reasons why Christians and churches need to be engaged in doing good works in society. And I'm just going to rattle off that list for you. These are the reasons we need to be engaged. Number one, because we love our neighbors. Number two, to show the world God's character and His work. Number three, because good works are the fruit of the Holy Spirit's work in us. And number four, to win a hearing for the gospel. Doesn't that sum it up well,
that
Dean?
That does indeed. And Rita, I want to just go back to one thing that you quoted Minnery as saying, where it says, it is an exciting privilege that God has chosen us to do this. But He also says, we have a choice. We have a choice to obey, or we have a choice to disobey. So this is a conscious decision on our part, and we need to be responsive to His call.
Absolutely. Well, that's about all of our time for today, so we need to close. And to our listeners, if you would like to listen to this program again or share it with your friends, just go to our website at www.valleyfamilyforum.org and click on the link to Crossroads on the homepage. I also want to thank two of our great sponsors, Blue Ridge Chimney Service and Scott Dunaway's Dental Practice. Check them out and let them help you with your chimney and your teeth. And as always, we are deeply grateful for your prayers, your encouragement, and your generous financial support. If you would like to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep this program on the air, you can do so by sending a check to P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, Virginia, 22803. Thank you again for joining us. I'm Rita Dunaway with Dean Welty and our engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week at the Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. Until then, have a great week putting your faith into action.
Rejoice, 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 rej